Good evening. I'm Michael McCusker. I'd like to read something. It's a letter to the editor of the Daily Astorian. I might or might not submit, and they might or might not accept and print. But as I have written at the moment, I sense an opportunity to perform a vital community service as a result of the State Ethics Commission's claim of not having the time to investigate former Sunset Empire Transportation Director Cindy Howe's possible ethical transgressions. I think I might stick up every large corporate bank in Oregon and redistribute their purloined wealth among those whose lives have been crushed by the Great Recession, those who have lost their homes, their jobs, their pensions, not to mention the schools and programs helping the destitute that are being ravaged by shrinking budgets due in substantial part to taxpayer bailouts of those very same banks whose obviously unethical avarice caused the financial breakdown. After redistributing the money to those it was literally stolen from, I will surrender myself to the police, reasonably confident the State Board of Ethics will not have the time in the foreseeable future to adjudicate my activities as either ethical or criminal. So that is a possible submission to the Daily Astorian. And I guess I should probably give the disclaimer that what I just read and what I am going to read is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire cosmos and multiple universes. Today is my father's 98th birthday, or would have been if he had not died 13 years ago. I'd like to read something I wrote at the time, just after his death, which I have revised somewhat because everyone of his generation of my family has subsequently died in the intervening 13 years. I wrote this initially for Hipfish at their request in 1998, the year he died. He was born on June 2nd, 1913, and died February 6th, 1998. Born on 6-2, died on 2-6. Astoria's unique and eclectic public radio station, KMUN-FM, aka Free Radio Columbia Pacific, played songs about dead mothers the night before Mother's Day, the year my father died. So, for Father's Day, which is upcoming, I wrote about my dead father that year and am reading for the same thing today. He died in February 26, 1998. He would have been 98 today on 6-2. His name was William Copeland McCusker, whose middle name traced back to the Revolutionary War on his maternal side, an Irish-American who married my mother, Josephine, a Sicilian born of boat people. I sat next to his bed in a hospital while he slept through his final morning. I was reading a book and holding his hand when he quit breathing a little past noon. I stood up and stared at him. His breathing had been strong and steady. Its abrupt stop startled me. It took a few seconds to realize my father's life had just ended. I walked out of the room to the nurse's station. A tall, thin RN looked at me. "My father has stopped breathing," I said. Another nurse walked past me into the room. He had not resumed breathing. "This is what happens," the nurse said. She felt his carotid and shook her head. I noticed for the first time that his oxygen humidifier was not on. I wondered if his oxygen was on, but hesitated. His breathing had been regular up to the instant he abruptly stopped forever. I thought an attempt to satisfy my curiosity might be taken as unfair criticism of the medical staff. I realized it made no difference. He was dead. His dying was ended. I wondered if I should call my family or wait till an MD declared him dead. I voiced my indecision to the nurse. She said it was my choice, but advised I call. My younger brother, summoned from California for the final vigil, answered the phone. I think you'd better come, I said. I bent over and kissed my dad's forehead. I held his hand. Tears popped into my eyes, and I told anecdotes about him to the nurse and a chaplain who came into the room, a young and pretty woman who patiently listened to my disconnected accounts of his life. I mentioned a seagull I had seen earlier flying into a silver sun shining through clouds, a cliché about birds winging human souls to heaven. I spoke like a Luddite in my lamentation that science has dissipated myth and mysticism, that death is treated as simply a mechanical process, bereft drama or spirituality. And when I noticed a TV on the wall above my father's bed had continued a Perry Mason episode uninterrupted while he died, I ranted that television exploits and trivializes humanity's deepest emotions and intimacies to huckster the unnecessary and inedible. The chaplain asked if I wanted a priest. I eagerly agreed, apologizing for the seeming sexism of my response, explaining that my father had always felt secure and comfortable in the company of priests, a few of whom were childhood friends and fellow altar boys. Nurse and chaplain left me alone with him. I felt he picked me to be with him for his death and realized my entire life with him, all our arguments and reconciliations led up to this moment. So this is what being his firstborn child was all about, I thought. I remembered a book I read when I was a boy, which I knew was still in my parents' library. An early English king said when both a son and his father, the old king, died simultaneously, that God could provide another son, but never again a good father. A priest came into the room and said prayers for my father, and again later at my request when my family arrived and discovered our beloved patriarch dead. My sister and brother handled the funeral. I wanted to put his body aboard an old boat and bury him at sea, a distinctly minority option. My sister said the traditional funeral was to please our mother, but admitted that his expense, which was more than double an insurance policy my mother thought covered both their funerals, worried her and caused a paradox. I tried to console my mother, who had grown up with my father. They were married 57 of the 70 years they knew each other. She was both disappointed and relieved that she had not been present when he died. She had spent his last night in the room with him and only went home at the insistence of her children. I held her and we both cried. I told her that he probably wished to spare her witness to his death and that he put a demand on my firstborn responsibility by dying in my company. We both knew it was my job, I said. I was afraid she would also die soon after my father, like longtime couples do. But she lived a full decade more, dying at age 95 on June 26, 2008, 3 years ago this month. A friend whose parents are dead told me after his father's death, 4 years after his mother died, that a person is not truly grown up until both are gone. Ironically, the fathers of several friends died within close range of my dad's death. I thought we should form a father's club from the title of a book, and perhaps help our grieving through shared anecdotes about our fathers, or at least get soused together whenever mourning got any of us too far down. A friend whose mother died previously said the night she found her father dead in his apartment, "Now I'm nobody's daughter anymore." The grown daughters of a friend asked me if they should let him go, following a second stroke. Their mother had died earlier, and they were sad their parents had short lives. Another friend told me his father died a few years earlier. "Now your dad's really going to come through your skin," he said. And he has. I do not slight my mother's influence, especially her vision of planet Earth as Gaia. My father's pull on my orbit was more directly masculine, the values and disciplines of the killer side of the family. Much of what I am and try to be is because of him and despite him. I am his son even now, 13 years after he died, and I still feel his towering patrimony, a visceral link with the first man I ever knew. My family delegated me to write a short eulogy for his friend, the parish priest, to read at his funeral. My initial attempt was cut to pieces by my mother, her sister, and my two siblings. Each had their own strong versions of the meaning of his life, and I eventually came up with a satisfying composite of our separate images. My favorite image of him is as a young man, 20 years old, when he volunteered to drive much-needed medical supplies to an earthquake-stricken area at great risk to his life from aftershocks and crumbling buildings. I think, however cogent the rest, my image of him as the young rescuer of the sick and injured is the one he and I share. And that is something I wrote, and which was originally published in Hipfish, June 1998, and which I have just recently revised. And if you'll indulge me a little bit longer, while I was digging through to find that article on my father, I found something that I had written years earlier when I worked in a local hospital. Seaside Hospital. And so I thought maybe I would just continue on the medical part of the program here with some of these thoughts. I called it Bedpan Patrol. I worked in the fall of 1977 as an orderly, or nurse's aide, ward healer in the local butcher shop on the graveyard shift. I was hired by a new director of nurses, a dark, bearded Jewish young man who became interested in medicine while laying in a military hospital with a bullet in his chest from Vietnam. I became unavoidably aware of the contradictions inherent within the medical profession while I served on Bedpan Patrol. I was also a volunteer fireman and member of the volunteer emergency rescue team. I had become an EMT, emergency medical technician, earlier that year. Quite often I pushed people through the medical system, gift wrapping them in the raw and inserting them into the emergency room, and afterward poked thermometers into their rectums while they lay in a hospital bed recovering from injuries and my assistance. The graveyard shift played hell with my sleep. Most days were my nights, and a full moon in a clear black sky is a pale sun for one who likes to sleep curled in the darkness of a womb and wake up to morning's aurora. Beloved of coyotes and burglars, night belongs to them and to owls and bats, not to me. Most patients slept through the graveyard, always watched over, soft footsteps padding along the wards, doors to rooms opened a crack, an ear listening for sounds of breathing or distress, often quietly entering to rearrange a pillow, pull up a blanket, or apologetically awaken someone to turn over in bed to prevent sores from developing. And I always had to wake up a few to take their vital signs around 2 o'clock, take their blood pressures, pulses, respiration, and temperatures. Late at night, people who could not sleep wished to share their inner lives and fears. And of course, I would have to listen. I went to work every night with the great dread of medical people that I might kill someone through an act of carelessness or neglect, that I would not know what to do, or that I would do the wrong thing. I was afraid I might leave someone to die because I stepped outside a room for a cigarette, which I smoked in those days, a cup of coffee, or simply wanted to escape the demands of a patient's condition or complaints. The generic paradox intrinsic to medicine is that the desire to help others in distress might, contrarily, kill them. Because we put ourselves in the positions to cure, we risked annihilation of the person we cared for. I was at the raw end of medicine, the insertion point of emergency response and temporary patch-up, which included life-saving and failure. My rating was as an EMT-1, the tenderfoot of emergency medicine, and I was a volunteer on a fire department rescue team. My job at the hospital on bedpan patrol also included rushing to the hospital emergency room whenever someone was brought in. I gave a great deal of CPR to elderly people, breaking the bones in their chests with my compressions as if they were sparrows. One night we had a bizarre murder. a woman and her former boyfriend accused of killing her fiancé when all three, plus a hitchhiker, drove to Seaside for the couple's wedding. The intended groom was apparently worth some money, a large amount of which was claimed to have been looted from his body. The car crashed following the murder, and at first police thought the victim had died in the collision, but quickly realized he had been bludgeoned to death. The survivors were brought to the hospital under loose police guard. The two men had head injuries and were x-rayed and put into a room with adjoining beds. The woman was given a separate room. A cop stayed with us the rest of the night. When I went into the woman's room to give her the first of hourly neural tests and blood pressure and pulse checks, she told me fearfully that the two men in the other room had murdered her fiancé. All of them were drunk, she said, and started quarreling in the car. They stopped, and her former boyfriend and the other man, who was not a hitchhiker but a friend of the ex, beat her fiancé to death and robbed him. She was forced to drive, she said, but was so frightened she lost control of the car and hit something. I told the cop what she said. He thought I should make my normal rounds and say nothing. So every hour I gave neural response tests to the woman and the two men. In the morning, my shift ended. The day shift was told the situation, which was now their problem. The three were gone when I returned the next midnight. I believe they were put in jail in Portland, but I don't remember what happened to them. I was infatuated at the time I worked at the hospital with a young woman who quit her waitress job in Cannon Beach and went up to Point Barrow on the Arctic Circle to work on a radio station owned and managed by Jesuit priests. I wrote her a letter in 1977, which included some hospital episodes. Among my patients is a man who is dying of cancer and knows he is dying. I have been studying Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying to help me relate to him in the various stages, of which she says are generally four, though not everyone lives long enough to get through them all. Denial, anger, grief, acceptance. My patient is in between denial and anger, and it is at night, as it so often is, that he feels most afraid and lonely. I am accustomed to violent death, but not the long, slow process of death in bed of illness. There is nothing I can promise him on either side of the grave, only that I will also die. It is the process of dying, not death itself, that is the most frightening, and I try to assure him that he will not die in pain but unconscious, virtually as painlessly as he was born. He is afraid that he will die in his sleep and no one will be there. I try to assure him that at least I will be there. He gets angry and bitterly admonishes my youth, I was 36 at the time, and presumed life ahead of me. I tell him of Vietnam and that I take every day as extra time. I am not sure why I have. It is not enough to assure him I will die. I am sure he would rather I die in his place, but that is impossible. And if it were possible, I would not do it at any rate. My turn will come. That is all I can tell him. The anger is easy enough to take and is actually easier for me than the disbelief. Both of us will suffer his grief, and I hope he lives long enough to accept death without either anger or too much grief. Then I wonder if he will feel a little sorry for me because I have to die also. Or will he think that death is not so bad after all and wish he could assure me that I have nothing to be afraid of? A great anatomist, William Hunter, said just before dying, "If I had the strength to hold a pen, I would write how easy and pleasant a thing it is to die." The way he died, perhaps. I hope it is as pleasant in the end for my patient. Epicurus wrote more than 2,000 years ago, "He is foolish who says that death is to be feared, not because it will be painful when it comes, but because it is painful to look forward to. For it is vain to be grieved in anticipation of that which distresses us, not when it is present. Death, then, the most dread of all evils, is nothing to us. For while we are here, death is not. And when death is here, we are not." But death was an abstract to Epicurus when he wrote that, an exercise in thought. I do not know how he died, so I have no way to compare his words with how he actually met his death. I am almost hamstrung by the deaths I have seen, hardly any of them pleasant or inspiring of anything other than terror. I suspect my death will not be pleasant, but if I have time for more than a gasp or two, I might resign myself to it. I have seen others who did not die immediately of their terrible wounds give themselves over to death, and though it is a cushioning, an almost gentle slide over to the other side, it might only have been the physical onset of cerebral shock from the destruction of tissues and organs. Speculations such as these lead into the ancient pursuit of what separates the body from the soul, if indeed there is one, and if there is, might it only be the transformation of energy from mass? I know simply that to adequately assist the man who is dying in the hospital, I have to put my memories and fears aside and deal with him from his experience, not my own. It is his death we are both concerned with. Mine will come later, unless a logging truck sends me ahead to welcome him. Either way, I will not die his death, and my death will not give him a reprieve from his own. The country hospital, for that is what it is, awaits my nocturnal footsteps along its antiseptic corridors. Graveyard shifts, empty coffee pots, and fill ashtrays, and albeit the medical education I am receiving via the look-see monkey method, I am also becoming expert on late-night television movies. I take to work each time a great fear, one that I believe everyone in medical work more or less shares to some extent, and that is that I might kill someone through carelessness or neglect, that I will not know what to do or do the wrong thing. A sense of inadequacy makes me afraid, and I am sorely tempted to purposely limit my knowledge and responsibility and make it understood that I am incapable of doing certain things because I am unwilling to learn them and be responsible for them. It is a paradox not entirely generic to medicine, but certainly intrinsic within it. The desire or need to help others in distress might contrarily destroy them. Because we put ourselves in the positions to cure, we inadvertently risk annihilation. It is an unspoken terror that releases itself most often through laughter, and I think I am more afraid of it than anything else, even the loss of my own life. Fortunately, solemnity is not common among hospital staffs, nor others for that matter, who work around or are otherwise close to suffering and death. The solemn types often find themselves incapacitated around such things and generally do not opt for this line of work. They want someone else to do it and to dig the graves also. Interestingly enough, they look upon us sometimes as ghouls, at least morbid. Only the morbidly sick would laugh around sickness and death. So some have said, and others must silently agree. They forget that constant exposure to mortality is a root of laughter. We laugh and joke around in the emergency room and on the wards for the same reasons my friends and I laughed and joked when we were terrified and surrounded by the dead and dying in combat. Laughter keeps us sane. Laughter also increases circulation and respiration, keeps the flesh healthier. It is healthy to open the crypt and laugh again at the laughing echoes. At Seaside Hospital, we laugh also, because any one of us might get the sack any time. The hospital is going broke, because not enough of our neighbors are sick or dying. It will not matter that tending the sick and dying is as personal to us as love. If any of us lose our jobs, it will be entirely impersonal. Computers figure out cost analyses and the ratios of staff per patient. I will be among the first to go because the axe chops from the bottom. The funds were unlimited when I was in the killing business, but if I am booted out of the healing business, it will be because there is not enough money. Which is what happened. I was put on call and not often called. Perhaps also for the reason that I despised the hospital administrator and was carelessly open and public about my antipathy. The hospital administration company he worked for was itself booted out of the hospital for fraud the following year, replaced by another lowball outfit, until finally Sisters of Providence, who operate St. Vincent's Hospital in Beaverton near Portland, were brought in and have run it officially since, though some of their Catholic reasoning rubs up against the fact that Seaside is a public hospital. No abortions are performed, for instance, and birth control information must be gleaned elsewhere. And I wrote that in the 1980s, so it might not be true now. The woman I wrote the letter to returned to Cannon Beach a couple of years later with a husband. He was an all-American sort of fellow, yet found me curiously interesting, as he put it. I finished my letter to her with a glimpse of my milieu the day of my mother's 65th birthday, which is when I wrote the letter. I lived in a little white house in a glade of trees at the end of a street 2 blocks from the ocean in Cannon Beach. Glancing at the clock, I notice it is almost time to don my whites and catch a ride to work. My own laughter will be flat against the wind in a moment. The winds have roared through here the past few days, tearing things up and blowing down trees and power lines. Heavy tides have washed 5 people out to sea south of here and left in exchange for them huge piles of driftwood against sandbanks and seawalls. Great black marbles of rain-swollen clouds have shot across the sky and dumped their urine in hammering gushes, flooding streets and some beachfront motels whose designers ignored the Pacific Ocean. For the moment, we seem suspended between assaults. Outside the window, an upside-down crescent moon is riding the cloud tops, dipping into them and swinging over their crests like a small boat in a gale. I might see some stars when I walk along the beach toward my ride to the hospital. For a couple of nights last month, at least 100 fish boats swung on their hooks along the horizon, and their many lights were like a city. I had the illusion that I was at sea, staring toward shore. Tonight, I think I will see mountains of another storm, lighted by the skipping moon. That is mostly some stuff I wrote in the late 70s, while I worked at Seaside Hospital for nearly a year before I was sort of booted by this hospital administration. That was itself replaced by another, and then finally by the sisters who have been in the hospital ever since. My friend, the head nurse, I think he is retired now. He got shot in the chest, and he was under medical care for, about a year. And he thought he owed medicine his life, and he definitely repaid it by becoming an RN for, I guess, most of his professional life. And he was my neighbor. Leonard Nadoff was his name, a damn fine man. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.